Okay, now we're gonna do something a little bit different. We're going off-piste. Ready?
Now, this morning we're going to explore the psychogeography of everyday life. I know, it's early, but look, bear with us. Psychogeography, yes, it's a bit of a word, as in, what on earth does that even mean? A definition is not far away, I can assure you of that. To discuss how bricks and mortar and all the other physical realities that surround us, how they twist our minds and make us what we are, or at least make us what we feel, I'm joined by Dr. Colin Ellard. Now, he's a professor of cognitive neuroscience and director of the Urban Realities Laboratory at the University of Waterloo, that is in Canada, and he joins us now via Skype from Waterloo. Colin, welcome.
Thank you.
Can we begin with that tricky matter of definition, psychogeography, in 100 words, without hesitation or repetition? What is that?
Oh, gosh, it's pretty late at night here, so I can't guarantee no repetition, but I'll give it a go.
Okay.
Psychogeography is the study of the relationship between the places that we move through in our everyday life and the effects that those places have on our minds. And so it encompasses things like the ways that, for example, something like an urban streetscape might affect your feelings, your emotions, what kinds of things it might make you do, how it might affect the way that you pay attention to your surroundings, remember things, and make decisions.
Okay, so it's something that we're utterly aware of, but may not have had the capacity to isolate or describe.
Yeah, exactly. It's something that at some level I think everybody knows, that where you are influences what you do and how you feel. Mm. So in psychogeographic studies, what we do is we try to kind of deconstruct those relationships using a variety of different tools, either by conducting experiments right on the street, where we can measure things like people's stress levels, for example, their brain waves, their eye movements, to other kinds of experiments in our laboratory where we can build virtual spaces, we can build virtual streetscapes, virtual building interiors, and get a bit more control over the relationship between person and place in order to study it.
It's wonderful that this can be an empirical study rather than just some piece of arcane cultural theory. This can be measured.
Yeah, it's a wonderful time to be doing this kind of work because every day it seems there are new kinds of tools that are available for us to be able to very precisely measure the kinds of relationships that we're interested in.
What makes us love a place and what makes us hate a place?
Oh, there are so many different factors, beginning with the sensory environment. So one of the things that we understand best about these kinds of relationships has to do with the visual sense, because we human beings are preponderantly visual. So we know, for example, that certain kinds of shapes appeal to us more than others. We know that we have an affinity for example, curves rather than sharp angles. And that plays out in the experiences that we have on the street. I think many people have had the experience of looking at a beautiful curved walkway or curvature in a piece of architecture and responding to that at kind of a visceral level, as opposed to something that's very sharp and angular that we may not feel as inclined to approach as we would something with curves. So that's one simple example of the sensory appeal of different kinds of environments. But you can also look at things like memory, the things that we come to know about a place. Once we're very familiar with an environment, then we begin to see through the immediate sensory experience to the level of recollection, things that we know, remember, experiences that we've had in a particular place. So, everything from the first kind of sensations that we have when we come across a place for the first time to the connection of those sensory experiences with our memories can influence whether or not we like or don't like a particular place.
And yet we're complex, are we not? I mean, we can have a reaction to brutalist architecture in which we appreciate the aesthetic, in which we say, I really like that building, even though its fundamental architectural tenet is ugly and all those things that you describe as uncurved.
we can have those kinds of responses. And, that again points to the influence of things like experience and knowledge and culture in our reactions to places.
How much of that sense of what works for us is species-wide? I mean, and how much is it a product of those things you just mentioned, of education, of experience, of our learned selves?
I think a great deal of it is species-wide. I think, you know, some of the things that we know appeal to people almost universally in spaces are things that you can relate to biology. Here's an example. If you look at the shapes of spaces, think of something like public spaces. There's a quantity that we talk about in environmental psychology called the duality of prospect and refuge. The idea is basically that we'd like to be in positions where we have some kind of feeling of protection or refuge, but at the same time, we can see what's going on around us. We have a vista in front of us. And that's something that's really written into our genes. It's something that transcends even human beings and any kind of animal. If you look at studies of habitat selection, shows a preference for locations where they can see and not be seen. And so it makes biological sense in the way that you might consider being having protection from predators, being able to see opportunities for foraging and that sort of thing. In that way, it sort of makes a bit less sense with human beings, because typically when we're enjoying a nice public square, for example, we're not worried about being crept up on by predators, at least not literally. And yet those same kinds of contingencies act on us to push us towards locations where we have both high prospect and high refuge. And that sort of thing has been seen in all different kinds of human cultures and different kinds of people, different personalities. If you look at how people inhabit a public square, for example, you see that they most often are found around the fringes. Nobody particularly likes to stand smack in the middle of a big open space.
Exposed like and vulnerable.
Absolutely.
We're discussing the notion of psychogeography with a man steeped in this idea. He's a professor of cognitive neuroscience. His name is Dr. Colin Ellard. He's written about this, a new book, or a current book, Places of the Heart, the Psychogeography of Everyday Life, is that. And Colin, I wonder, given that those things are very much of the natural environment, a lot of the things which appeal to us as humans, I wonder if some of the deep misery of common humanity is because of the places that we have to live, the places that constrain us in suburbs and cities that don't take into account the psychogeographic effect.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I can think of a couple of different examples of that. One that we talk about all the time these days is the influence of exposure to views of nature. So there has been a resurgence of interest in the importance of people living in, for example, dense city environments, having connection with natural views. That resurgence is driven in part by a lot of research that shows that those kinds of views, those kinds of exposures to natural spaces, they really transcend something like an aesthetic consideration. So it's not, you know, sometimes we think of the parklands in a city as maybe being kind of like the dessert, you know, get everything else right, and then we can build these nice green spaces. But there's more and more evidence that exposure to those kinds of places has really profound effects on everything from things like our levels of cortisol, which is a stress hormone, to things like the way that we pay attention to the world, the way that we think, and the way that we feel. And so you can really make a good argument that exposure to natural environments is much more than an aesthetic. It's actually a public health concern. People tend to live longer and be healthier when they have those kinds of exposures.
Do they need to be natural environments, or can we create that sense in recreating nature or even a facsimile of nature?
That's a really interesting question. We've done some research in our lab where we've been trying to basically unfold what it is about those natural views that produces these marvelous physiological and psychological responses. And in part, it does seem to have something to do with the particular kinds of patterns that are present in natural images. Well, if that's true, to some extent, it ought to be possible to duplicate those kinds of effects in design that isn't necessarily natural, at least not obviously natural. And so we've had some success in doing that, for example, in virtual environments with presentation of particular kinds of images that have the right kinds of visual properties. So there are prospects for being able to produce some of the health-giving effects of natural imagery without actually using nature. But my suspicion is that in the long run, we're going to discover that the most economical and effective way of producing these kinds of effects is to include natural elements in cities.
Colin, thank you. That fascinating insight, if only momentary. We appreciate your time.
Oh, you're welcome.
Dr. Colin Ellard, he's a professor of cognitive neuroscience. He's director of the Urban Realities Laboratory at the University of Waterloo in Canada, discussing there the notion of psychogeography, an idea explored in his book, Google this, Places of the Heart, the Psychogeography of Everyday Life.